Facing challenges and overcoming setbacks is part of doing business. Whether you have the expertise to survive them or not could mean the difference between success or failure. Welcome to We Are Women, featuring revealing conversations that provide invaluable insights into the success secrets of female masterminds. A must listen for every entrepreneurial woman. Now here's your host, Janine Vosper.
Hi, it's Janine Vosper here, and this is another episode of the We Are Women podcast. I have the super fantastic and talented Marlene Cameron with me all the way from Calgary. Now, Marlene has been coaching entrepreneurs and executives for the past 20 years, and it's always intrigued her that smart and talented people can doubt their capabilities and fear that they don't belong in their roles. She helps her clients realize their innate capacity for greater clarity and natural confidence as experts and leaders, with a clearer understanding of their true nature and knowing they were designed for success, as we all are. Their capacity for greater productivity, happiness, and well-being expands effortlessly. So there's going to be, those that have listened to any episodes of the We Are Women podcast will know this is something that I just love discussing. And when I met Marlene and we had a conversation, I think our conversation went nearly as long as this podcast interview is going to be. We just found we resonated on so many topics. So welcome, Marlene. I'm so glad that you could be here.
Thank you.
I want to learn a little bit more about you. Tell us a little bit more about Marlene.
Well, I've had a varied career path. I actually started off as a commercial interior designer. So I guess the terminology, if I was in Europe, would be interior architect. I worked on large commercial projects. And I had a really good career in that. I found it extremely stressful, but even though I was successful. And I moved on and eventually did an MBA and went into finance and worked with organizations that were going public or raising financing. And then I took my my executive coaching training and then veered off again into a specialized field called energy psychology. And I taught a technique called emotional freedom techniques for about 15 years and certified other practitioners. But I noticed something when I was observing my students. I was noticing that their clients would kind of veer off into, you know, kind of thinking about worst case scenarios and, you know, what if that happens and getting really quite upset about it. And I thought, I wondered if there's a way that we can help clients kind of differentiate between what is the real scenario now in the present moment and what they're kind of forecasting, if you will, which is causing them a lot of concern and upset. And so a fellow trainer actually steered me towards the understanding that I work with now in my coaching practice.
That whole worst case scenario, I remember my mother-in-law saying to me, and she's passed and I dearly loved her and we got on extremely well, which is lovely with mother-in-laws. She said to me, you know, Janine, I worry about you because you don't worry enough.
Good one.
And she was a worrier. And it was that forecasting the scenario, isn't it? The what if this, whereas the what if really happens.
Yeah, there's a belief behind that the worrying sets us up to be prepared or to protect ourselves or to to deal with the situation should it indeed happen.
I remember when my oldest son first started driving, because that's always a worry time for parents, isn't it, when they're on the road. And he was working a part-time job at a coffee shop and he would go in after school and he would, it was probably about 20 kilometres away. And he'd often, depending on what shifts he was doing, he would often work from, say, 4 p.m. to when they closed. And sometimes they didn't close. But then day shift would be coming in. I never knew what time he was meant to be coming home. And he was driving one of our large four-wheel drive vehicles. And I had people say to me, "Oh, aren't you awake all night waiting for him to come home?" And my answer to that was no. They said, "Well, what happens if something happens to him?" I said, "Well, I'd rather be rested. And then I can deal with it. Either way, I can still open the door or answer the phone call. But I'd rather be rested and in control." And it was hard for some other people go, "Oh no, I'd have to be awake until they entered the door." And that didn't work for me at all because I'd rather be the person with the capacity to deal with the situation and not be dealing with, "Oh my gosh, Saturday night, I'm so fatigued, Sunday," type of thing.
Yeah. I think a lot of people wear themselves out with worrying.
Yeah. And is that
Yeah.
where is worry that I know we're going to be talking about that imposter syndrome as you sort of you haven't said the words yet, but it's very much what that people setting themselves up for when they don't have that belief. Is that the energy behind it? Fear?
Yeah, I think it is, well, I would say there's probably three aspects around imposter syndrome. First of all, it is usually very capable people, very talented, very successful in their own right, that somehow, because they can't internalize their success, they attribute it all to something outside of themselves, like they were just lucky, or somebody liked them, or they worked way harder than others, or it was just a downright mistake, that they succeeded or were selected or what have you. So that sets people up for not kind of believing in themselves and seeing their own capabilities and talent. And then the other piece of that is that, well, I was lucky or I accomplished that because of these factors which are not controllable or predictable. I could mess up, and then for sure people will discover that I'm not, the competent, capable person I've kind of portrayed myself to be. And so that sets them up for what we call this fear, this worrying, to kind of always been vigilant about how they're presenting themselves, how their work looks, how people would potentially, perceive the quality of their work. And the third factor is because of this enormous focus on self, this self-consciousness, if you want to call it that, or this self-monitoring or self-assessing, people can feel very alone and very disconnected and not actually feel that they belong to the groups or the organizations that they're part of.
Okay, I would never. There's quite a few points there that I want to draw on, but the self, with that self-assessing, then feeling alone, it's really, I'd never sort of drawn those together, but it sort of makes sense that that's how it is because, well, we're not going to share those fears with anybody else, are we?
No, I talked to an HR professional, and it's interesting because we can kind of see when somebody who's obviously capable, feel a little unsure about themselves, or and it's so we can, it's almost like it's an observable when somebody has this, this self-doubt or this temporary insecure feelings. But nobody wants to admit that, right? And just like that, that Achilles heel that you wouldn't ever want to show that side of you. And yet, for myself, it was like I was always trying to appear a certain way, like appear that I was confident, appear like I was capable, and I was. But because I didn't believe that, or I didn't resonate with that, and I was projecting myself that way, there was this sense of inauthenticity. And I found that very exhausting, like going out to networking groups and things like that, and having to kind of, hold up this version of myself that took a lot of effort. And so that, yeah, that was, it's it was very hard for me to really connect with people because I was so busy,
Yeah.
yeah, kind of maintaining a certain image or profile that I thought would kind of mask, what I really felt about how I saw myself.
That's really interesting. I've had four conversations this morning. So for those listening, it is my time. It's 10 a.m. I've had a really early start today. I've had four conversations, and the conversations about being authentic have come up three times. Whether that's the flavor for 2024, not sure, but I think it's such an important factor because when you are authentic and true to yourself, then you can make decisions where you can actually trust yourself, can't you?
Exactly. It feels effortless. It feels you can relax. You can, like you say, be yourself, or let down any pretense or any guard or any idea that you have to be anything that anything other than that what you really are.
Something that's just popped in my head is the th three words, just I am. And that's to be able to get to a space where it is just, and I don't normally use the word just, but the two words I am, that's honest, isn't it? That two, and I think that when people are in that, what you've explained about how they're feeling, that everything has come from the outside, their success is not related to their capacity to solve problems, do the job, be the greatest technician, whatever it is, then they don't recognize that those two words, I am.
And we, over the course of life, we adopt all these ideas about ourselves, and maybe even some labels about ourselves, or ex some expectations about ourselves. And I love what Brené Brown talks about, this pleasing, performing, proving, and perfecting. That's sort of the life of somebody who feels like an imposter.
So what were those four again, just so that the people listening?
Oh yeah,
I haven't
well,
listened to Brené Brown, but please.
well, she writes about the pleasing, performing, and perfecting, and I added in the proving.
Okay, yeah. And that's such an important factor. How can I prove this? Do you see a difference with men and women with this? Is there a noticeable difference? This imposter syndrome, where I have to, well, particularly please people.
There could potentially be a difference. I would see two different ways of coping with it, if you want to call it that, is somebody who just simply holds themselves back. They stay out of the limelight. They may turn down, promotion. They not may not even apply for a position that they could easily do, or even the quality of clients they would want if they were an independent consultant. And then there's others that are kind of take a more kind of bluffing approach, and are able to kind of build themselves up, and come across as very like over the top, self-assured type of thing. So I mean, there's probably many ways, different ways of coping with it, but I see that. And I don't And I don't know if that's just based on gender, or just how people are. Women are often get more messaging around being nice and polite, and trying to be as perfect as possible. Maybe men not so much.
Yes, I remember reading an article years ago that it said if a woman is applying for a job, they have to feel they have to be able to do 80% of the criteria, whereas a man it's 20%.
I've heard, similar studies to that, or even the idea that if there's two resumes and one has a male name and one has a female name, men and women will deem the male candidate more capable. So there's that innate bias in our still in our culture. Yeah,
Yes.
that.
Yes. And that, and is that something that is recognized then through childhood? You know, there's different ways that boys are treated differently than girls, and it's then that perception within that we carry through, because I think most of the junk, for those that are listening and can't hear me, I've done the little quotation signs, that
Yeah.
the junk we carry through our lives often comes from childhood experiences and those formative years, doesn't it?
I think there's some different messaging for sure, between early life with girls and boys, how they're what expectations are set for them, what's modeled to them, through their own parents. And then we get all kinds of cultural influences through advertising, and even as adults, we still see women, kind of, there
In
to sell the
the bikini.
Yeah. And I know I speak with a lot of women. When you think about most industries, let's face it, historically they were all male majority industries. So I don't, there's very few that, you could say now there's historically been
Maybe
female majority.
nursing and teaching,
Yeah, or
probably.
maybe nursing teaching. But what I hear from the women who in those industries, even though they have, the education, the wherewithal, they just don't have the same reception as their male counterparts do in the organization.
How can they change that? How can we go, right, I'm not having that imposter syndrome anymore. I'm going to, but how do you work with people to adjust those beliefs?
One of the primary vulnerabilities for people who feel like imposters is this big concern over what they think other people think of them. And so they're judging and monitoring their own behavior, what they might speak up and say, what they might do, and how that will be received. And so if we're always in that process of self-monitoring and self-censoring, we don't get to be our authentic selves. We're kind of presenting a version of ourselves we think is going to be successful. But even if women, for example, are self-confident, self-assured, speak up, they may still not be viewed as an equal partner in an organization that has historically kind of a male majority, if you will. Because there's that, it's like I say, we all drank the Kool-Aid, and men have been kind of in those positions of power and prestige for many, many, many generations longer than women. So I think it's just a natural progression as women move into industry, government organizations, and find their place there.
It's interesting. I was at an event yesterday, and it was run by the State Chamber of Commerce, and there was opportunity for the opposition leader in our state to deliver some message. And one of the things I noticed, and I wore a dress and flat shoes because I had a fair bit of walking to do to get to the event. But I tend to wear flat shoes anyway. And I noticed all of the men were in suits and flat shoes. But the women are in high heels. And look, I love the look of high heels, but it's something that perception of how we look and how we dress and how we show up in the world. I mean, the men in the room, you could have, they're probably more black, grey, dark blue suits than you've seen anywhere. But it's this, it's a, it's, and I love looking pretty and, pretty as in what I'm wearing and taking time in how I dress. But it sort of jumped out at me yesterday that there was this different expectation. And it's not that, okay, the women have to dress a particular way, even though, it was a conservative event, that, but it, I was sort of wondering these thoughts, looking at the couple hundred people there, going, this is really, it was really telling that this was a business event, the business owners, and the men have a uniform. That's probably the way that I want to say it as well, where the where, and so once you're wearing that uniform, you fit a particular market, whereas the women, do they have to have a different type of uniform to fit this space where they're considered, they're not being judged? But I think women judge women more so than men judge women as well, saying that. There's
Yeah,
a
I
fair
think
bit in there,
so.
but I was just an observation, yes. So what, the women judging women or that uniform? What's your thoughts on
Yeah,
that?
I don't think it's as clear cut for women what although I did some research actually on what was considered professional attire for women, and it was very simple. Like, women were seen to be to have more credibility, to be more trustworthy if they dressed either like in a fitted dress or a suit and jacket or with a skirt or pants or something. And so there's and I always encourage women to dress up a little bit, because that it seems like there's more permission for men to be a little bit more casual, a little bit more laid back in their dress. But I don't think it's the same set of expectations for women. I think, we're still looking at the gap, if you will, and I think women do better by showing up looking professional and
Yes, rather than the accessory. Which is where that women's role has been historically as the accessory to the successful male.
It's interesting because one of the contributing factors to people having this experience of feeling like an imposter is kind of being the only one or the first one, so that could be like the only woman at the boardroom table. It could be people with different ethnic origins and who haven't historically been at the table, so to speak, and so they're that can bring on feelings like, well, do I really belong here, and do I measure up, and am I good enough? So, the more people like you have around you, there's a factor there that yes, I do belong here, and
I remember I was doing a presentation at a leadership forum, and it was a breakout room. And through the lunch hour, I'd been observing and listening to a lot of the women, and they were, CEOs of hospitals, senior government departments, senior executives in roles in different positions. And I'm listening to the conversations, and it was insecurity oozing out of people. It surprised me. I left school when I was 10 because that's what you did unless you were going to be a nurse or a teacher. I invested hundreds of thousands of dollars in various forms of education, but not necessarily what people would class as formal education over the years, and have acquired the knowledge and the capacity to do what I do. And I'm thinking, so here's me delivering this presentation to the, and it was about balance and belief in self and leadership. It was a little bit of a combo of topics, but here's me talking to these people with at least a degree, double degree, master's, doctorates in some of the cases, who were in that space where they were, I really don't trust myself in this role. And it was eye-opening for me as to go, so here am I in a space where I'm quite comfortable in what I'm doing, being able to hopefully share some ideas with them to be able to do it. But one of the things I asked the question was, what do you do for yourself? What is it that you do for yourself? It was crickets. There was nothing. And I'm thinking, that's possibly a startup. Someone said, oh, well, I go and run. And well, running's an exercise is fabulous, but it should be part of the normal routine anyway. It's, part of life. Or I get my hair done, which, oh, that's, yes, you would assume you do that for yourself, but is that really what is it that is your passion? What is it that represents something that you can get lost in and you can feel like you really are in your perfect place, that you trust yourself in that? Crickets. It was so surprising.
Well, it's interesting you should say that because the psychologist who identified, they called it imposter phenomena. They didn't ever intend it to be sort of like a syndrome. It's not a psychiatric disorder, but they were working with very highly educated women at one of the universities in the United States, and these women all had multiple degrees, PhDs. They were heads of department, and they were saying exactly the same thing as the women you spoke with. It's like, oh, I don't really deserve this. This is a, I don't even know why I'm here. I don't think I'm, capable. And so if originally the psychologist thought that this just afflicted women, because and then it was through further research and, having more conversations that they realized that men experience imposter syndrome too. But you think about, this would have been back in the late 1970s, like women in very high positions in academia, they would have been some of the early, early leaders in those positions, and feeling a little bit otherly, perhaps, because, they perhaps didn't have role models, and maybe they were the first women, or maybe even though they were head of department, maybe they weren't really, considered at the same level as their colleagues. We don't know, but it just seems to be is something that maybe women more so than men are vulnerable to because of their, their, as women move up in the workforce and in these organizations, they sometimes are the the early, the early ones.
And that just sort of makes me think that if so that's the 70s, then we're in 2024. We're talking, what's that, 50 years ago. There's many, many, many women have come through into top leadership and executive roles, and they're in government now. So has that still changed? Has that changed much?
You know, the reason why I think it hasn't changed is because there's a lot of lot of articles, a lot of books written on imposter syndrome, but most of what's been written is sort of helping people kind of cope with the insecurity, cope with the anxiety, cope with the the self-doubt or the uncertainty, because we really didn't understand where people's experiences were coming in the first place. I know from my own experiences, like I found that very confusing. It's like, why do some days I actually feel very accomplished and capable and optimistic, and other days, like I'm just down in the dumps with, procrastinating and anxiety and worry, and until I came to this understanding I mentioned, it's like I didn't know where that experience was coming from and why it was so variable. Because we've been led to believe that our experience comes to us from the outside world, so to speak. So I observe, situations and people and what have you. I absorb all that through my five senses, and then I have like a response to that, a reaction to that. So whatever I'm seeing, hearing, or noticing, and sometimes what I'm thinking about too causes my reaction. And we didn't realize that all of our experience comes from inside of us through a combination of our power to have thought and our power to bring these thoughts alive. So it looks like a real reality, but it's really a reality that's created from within in us. So it makes sense that if I'm having temporary discouraging thoughts, I'm going to feel discouraged. If I'm temporarily doubting myself, I'm going to temporarily feel anxious. And so when I started to see that connection and understand that that's what that was all about, and that it was temporary, because as I said, some days I was down the dumps, some days I felt really good. And realizing that that's just how human beings operate. We're always in the experience of the flow of our thoughts moment to moment. And if we can recognize it as a passing thought, it's not a truth about who we are, then those thoughts tend to, after time, tend to kind of drift by a little easier. And I don't spend so much time and energy on it, or even trying to fix how I feel, which I spent many, many years trying to fix how I feel.
Oh, it's all part of life, is part of learning, isn't it?
Yeah,
It
exactly.
is. And I love that you brought up the fact of thoughts, because what and part of what you've said, and for yourself and people you work with, don't realize you can think differently.
Right. Right.
I think that's the power of it all, isn't it?
Yeah.
Recognizing, that's a thought. I'll shift that thought around and I'll think differently. And then we create the connections in our brain that go looking for that new type of thinking, and we build more of those connections that have got that new type of thinking.
And even the idea that our emotions are just feedback. They're letting us know the quality of our thinking in the moment. So if I'm feeling frustrated or angry about something, I'm just having frustrating, angry thoughts about a situation, which I'll see probably see completely differently when I'm in a better mood.
Yes, it's I know it. I automatically, I've been married for a long time. It's very easy to have a reaction to some behavior that after 40 something years, you have dealt with that behavior and they have a reaction to it. But what I have learned is then I observe my reactions and go, in the moment, it's a reaction, and then within a short period of time, I've observed that reaction going, that was interesting. Did I need to do that? Oh, maybe I did. Or no, maybe I didn't need to react quite as extreme as that. And that's part of the power, to be able to observe yourself.
Right. Because if you can imagine that whatever we think we're observing between us and that is a thought. So it's like thoughts bring the experience of our experience to life, right? And then so you can see your partner, your husband, one way one day and another way another day, and it's the same human being. And you might be tempted to attribute it to what he said or did, but he's probably said or done that before, and it's like, well, whatever. Another day's it drives you nuts.
And you just happen to be tired at the time and short-tempered, and so you
Exactly.
responded differently.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
Yeah.
this is where I see a failure in some relationship. I mean, relationships are people's very individual space, whether they continue or don't continue. What I have observed is that once people start finding faults, they go looking for more faults. And that they are then validated because they've found more faults. So, from people who loved each other and often created other human beings, to a place where they can't stand each other and use those little human beings to battle against each other, how that they've gone from there to there. And I really truly believe it's all, well, this from my observations, it's changing the way that they've thought about a behavior, that and that just becomes, they find more and more and more, and then that's enough.
Yeah, you start to have a lot of thinking about that person. And the interesting thing is about thought, we have a power of thought. So we have lots of different kinds of thoughts. Is that sometimes we think they're actually true.
I did a competition speech on that, that we had, I think, between 45 and 50,000 thoughts a day, and they say that about 80% of them are negative. And I'm thinking, well, I don't have them, so someone's got mine, which would make it worse if that person. It is. They're just thoughts. They're not real.
Right. You know, it's interesting. They did a study with this understanding, just teaching people that they're living in the quality of their thinking moment to moment. And all of these people had suffered, high levels of anxiety. And so they had kind of like more conventional, therapy. And then they taught this other group this understanding. And so when they interviewed them, several months later, they asked the people with this new understanding, they said, "Well, we feel a lot less anxious." And they said, "Well, are you having any less, anxiety type thoughts?" They go, "No. I just don't pay attention to them anymore." So it's like we can't really control our thoughts. I mean, they come in so quickly, but we do have free will to the extent that we can decide where we want to put our attention.
Yes. And then we want to create more of that same space. I often suggest I if I'm having any of those thoughts, I will have, more so what I used to do. I don't necessarily do it now. I observe it a little bit more now. But I used to give it a voice, like a Donald Duck type voice. So it was, why would I pay attention to anything that sounds like that? I found that extremely powerful and have suggested others do it, and they've come back and said, well, not necessarily Donald Duck, but it's worked for them, and recognizing it that thought is not them, it's just a thought.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I like that what you said, living in the quality of your thinking. That's extremely powerful recognition of what everything that we've been talking about is. How are you living in that quality of your thinking and being observant to it? So is that something that this is where you go down the track when you're working with clients to get them thinking this way?
Well, what I focus on is not so much the content of their thinking, but the idea that they are thinkers and have thoughts constantly. And depending on our state of mind or our mood, we're going to have different quality of thoughts. And so consequently, we're going to see the world differently because we're bringing these thoughts alive, which includes our body feelings and any tension or agitation, our emotional state, and all our five senses are also impacted by this capacity to bring our thoughts to life. And the people will go through, the day, and there's just this natural ebb and flow, up and down. And if we understand that our default state is actually mental health and well-being, then we can more easily ride out those periods of discouragement or despair or frustration or anger, and just knowing that, if we don't put too much more attention or try to fix it, we'll naturally move out of that state and into a better feeling state, and life will just look nicer.
That's an important factor, isn't it? This is this we've got to fix it. So we'll, and there's a lots of people that are in a situation where their psychiatrists and psychologists and other things that they do will definitely help them, again, air quotes here, fix it. But do we necessarily need fixing?
Well, that's what's so radical about this new understanding. I don't think we ever really fully appreciated that human beings are actually created quite perfectly. Like we weren't, if you think about if somebody has an injury and they cut their hand, the skin heals. Well, if we have a very upsetting or disturbing experience in our lives, like we're not, I mean, we have the capacity to move past it, recognize that that's something, that wasn't pleasant, or but it doesn't really impact who we are at our deeper core. We're, we had a bad experience, but we're still okay. We're not broken. We're, and the more we can kind of stay away from going back and kind of rehashing that, and just sort of stay in a, a happier place in the present moment, we're fine.
Being in the present moment is, I think, a very powerful tool as soon as you start that rehash of something that's gone on, because it drains your energy. And I often talk about, even in the daily things, is NMP, it's not my problem. We take on other things. We might be driving along and we see that the children haven't got their seatbelts on in the car next to us. So automatically that emotion rises in us, the injustice, they should have their seatbelts on. How dare those parents? We get to where we're going and we go, oh, you should have seen, I was driving here and this car next to me didn't have that. We may tell the story five times and we've owned that intensity of that motion. It's not my problem. I get people to put NMP all over everything that they if they need to, in the car, on their computer, they'll it, I look, I'm one to jump in this. I'm certainly opinionated when it comes to a whole lot of political issues that they're trying to convince us of different things here in Australia, and I see it worldwide as well. I will jump on them. So that's a different space of not my problem. I will bring attention to issues because I feel that is my problem. But there's like the example I gave with the kids in the car. I can't change that. I can't influence that under any circumstances whatsoever. But all I've done is create and bring in this intensity and motion that's going to affect my day and then possibly affect how I deal with other people and deal with myself as the day goes on.
Yeah, that's why if you catch yourself feeling, kind of cranky or annoyed or, it's like, okay, just check in, because nothing's wrong here except that, you're using your amazing power of creative thought to, create a scenario for yourself.
I often say and it's a proven goldfish. I've got longer memory than 7 seconds, but I often say that I'm like a goldfish. If I've had an argument, hence why I've been married so long. If I have an argument with my husband and I'll go, well, I'm not talking to him, but 10 minutes later, I forget that I'm not talking to him. I just, well, okay, not a big deal. And it's much more pleasant to have a conversation rather than hang on to whatever I was
Right.
annoyed about.
And that's the resilience that we're all looking for, that's already built into our psychological system. It's already built in. If we can just let that, in thinking go, we'll bounce back and we'll be fine. And all will be forgiven.
It certainly makes it easier. I just go with the easy path. That works for me, and it does. It makes life a lot easier. Although, as I said, I do stand up to it. I do have a voice on things that are important, and I think we all need to do that as well and recognize that. But not, that's the thing, is you can have a voice and be passionate about something, but not take it on if, well, if someone else doesn't believe the same, or if somebody else doesn't have those same thoughts. Because that creates intensity again. It's not my problem. They don't think the same. That's not my problem.
Well, now with this understanding of how we experience our own reality, we literally never see things the same way somebody else does, because we're not actually observing directly what's outside of us. We've got this internally generated image and experience of that situation. And so it's just, it would be a miracle if we saw things exactly the same way, actually. And so to recognize that we don't, if somebody has a different opinion or different values or different expectations, that's just how it works.
Yes, and stepping back and recognize it.
Yeah.
I always ask my guests to provide three takeaway points because we've covered a lot of ground here, Marlene.
Okay.
This is what usually happens with them. We wander down some different paths and
Yeah.
different things come up. So if what would be three takeaway points that you would want everyone to remember?
Well, this whole thing that, people label themselves as imposters or they think they're imposters. Nobody's an imposter, but you can have a lot of imposter thinking. Like you can innocently believe that you're not perfect enough or good enough, and that's just not true and who you are. And the idea that while we're not our thoughts, we live in the experience of our thoughts. So it behooves us to be able to kind of step back, as you mentioned, and kind of see yourself in action. If especially if you're having a lot of judgment about yourself or somebody else, it's like, okay, here I am having a lot of thinking about this situation, but that all passes. So if we can understand that we're, this you don't need to identify with your thoughts and your beliefs and your expectations. And the third thing is this, this fact, I'm going to call it, that our default state of mind is happiness and well-being and confidence and optimism. If you think about, look at children, like how spontaneous they are and how uncensored and how unworried they are about their performance or what people think, and they just, are fully expressed and enjoying life. And then over time, we start to kind of self-assess and self-monitor, which is the very process that can kind of start to lower our well-being. But when we remember that we have that unlimited capacity for that confidence, that sense of calm, that mental clarity, life, we can do life with a lot more grace and ease.
Yeah, that's lovely. And that's some really good points to take away. How can people get in touch with you if they want to know more about how you can might be able to help them?
Oh, for sure. So my website is marlenecameron.com, and my email is marlene@marlenecameron.com. And I'd love to have a conversation with anybody who heard something that they're curious about in this conversation.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that expertise. I love these conversations. One of the reasons I continue to do my podcast is because of these conversations, Marlene. I love the ripples that, and for those who've listened in the past, understand how, I've had feedback from people that's changed their lives when they've been listening to it. But it's that having real conversations that improve me by hearing my experts speak rather than what I call washing machine conversations or just general things. But this fills my space having these. So thank you very much. I really
You're very
appreciate it.
welcome. Yeah, you're very welcome.
And that's another episode of the We Are Women podcast. I am Janine Vosper, your host. Remember to go to janinevosper.com, book a strategy call, and if I can help you, I will make some great suggestions on how you may step into your being and have your find your voice. If not, if I can't help you, I can direct you to all of the amazing women that I know that I'm sure there's someone there that'll be perfect for you. Have a fantastic day, week, month, wherever you are listening to this in the world. And I look forward to you joining me on the next episode of the We Are Women podcast. Bye bye for now.
So, do you feel stuck in a rut in business? Visit speechperfect.com.au and download Janine's free ebook to avoid the five most common stumbling blocks women face in business. It's jam-packed full of tips to overcome the barriers that could be holding you back from the success that you dream your business will be. We would love you to leave a review of today's episode and share this podcast with other women in need of entrepreneurial inspiration. Subscribe to the next episode now and join the We Are Women community.